a year in kickbacks from United. And if they were doing their job, they would do some research on seven or eight different insurers, and they would say, here are the pros and cons of this one and that one. But the only insurance company that they are co-branded with is United Healthcare, and they get about $250 million a year in dues. They get four times that in kickbacks from United. Some people might say this is a sham nonprofit. It's really an insurance marketing scheme disguised as an organization for the elderly, and I'm going to be following up on that.
Well, Bob Cutner, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Robert Cutner is co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. We'll link to your piece, How Musk Outmaneuvered Trump. He's also a professor at Brandeis University. When we come back, we'll speak with a French journalist who says she found sisterhood as she covered the rape trial of Gisèle Pelicot. She's the 72-year-old French woman whose landmark rape case galvanized France when she insisted on dropping her anonymity. On Friday, Pelicot's husband, Dominique, and 50 other men were sentenced for raping her for more than a decade. Back in 20 seconds.
Sans passé, les femmes, nous qui n'avons pas d'histoire. Depuis la nuit des temps, les femmes, nous sommes le continent noir. Nos femmes esclaves et brisons nos entraves. Debout, debout, asservies, humiliées. Les femmes achetées, vendues, violées. Dans toutes les maisons, les femmes hors du monde reléguées. Levons-nous, femmes esclaves, et brisons nos entraves.
Compagnie Jolimont, singing l'hymne des femmes, the women's anthem. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Merci, Gisèle. That was the nationwide response in France to Gisèle Pelicot, the 72-year-old French woman whose landmark rape case galvanized France. On Friday, her husband and about 50 other men were declared guilty and sentenced for repeatedly raping her for more than a decade after he drugged her unconscious. A panel of judges sentenced Dominique Pelicot to the maximum 20 years in prison. The shocking case made headlines around the world. The 3.5-month trial gripped France, with supporters regularly gathering around the Avignon Palais de Justice courthouse to support Gisèle Pelicot, who famously waived anonymity to give a voice to survivors and change the public discourse on sexual violence. She told the court during the trial, quote, "It's not for us to feel shame. It's for them," she said. She also insisted videos of her rapes that her husband had taken when she was fast asleep, drugged into sleep, that these videotapes be shown in the court as part of the trial. Gisèle Pelicot spoke after the sentencing on Friday.
Je pense enfin aux victimes non reconnues.
I'm thinking about the victims who aren't recognized and whose stories often remain in the shadows. I want you to know we share the same struggle. I wish to express my deepest gratitude to all those who've supported me throughout this ordeal. Your testimonies devastated me, and I was able to pull the strength from them to come back every day to face these long days of the trial.
Meanwhile, some women's rights activists supporting Gisèle Pelicot said they were disappointed with the verdict. This is Muriel Chirchet from the French feminist collective Nous Toutes, Us All.
Les viols, finalement, enfin pour les crimes, on peut prendre perpète avec.
For crimes, you can get a life sentence without parole for 22 years. And with rape, no. And yet, rape destroys lives. We spend our lives trying to get over it. There are secondary victims who have not even been taken into account. And so the minimum needed was to hit very hard with this justice.
Vraiment très, très.
Really, very, very, very disappointed. Very disappointed. And once again, well, our thoughts go especially to Giselle. To Giselle, who we will never thank enough. And on top of that, this verdict is a spit in the face. I have no other words.
For more, we're joined by Diane de Vignemont, a French journalist who covered the trial in Avignon. Her November piece for New Lines magazine is headlined Giselle Pellicot, Finding Sisterhood at France's Mass Rape Trial. She's based in Paris, but she just flew into New York. It's great to have you in studio. Welcome to Democracy Now, Diane. Explain the significance of this trial and the bravery of the 72-year-old woman who did something that most women in France, I mean, most do not bring cases against their rapists, but what happens when they go to trial even?
Hi, thanks for having me. So yes, the case is definitely exceptional, not only in the act himself, you know, the raping of a woman over 10 years by so many men, but also by the fact that Giselle decided to make it public. She waived her right to an anonymity, which most women in a rape case chose not to do, especially when the video evidence is so graphic.
And just for people who didn't follow this case, how can it be 50 men? In fact, it was something like 70, right? What happened over this decade, and how was Dominique Pellicot, her husband, found out?
Of course. So, yes, so it's 70 men, 20 of whom were not identified because the videos don't show their face. But Pellicot began drugging her, that we know of, 10 years ago with sleeping pills. And he recruited men on a website called Coco, where people do go for libertinage, so like swingers website. And he created a chat room called Against Her Will, à son insu, without her knowledge. And there he recruited men to come in and have sex with his wife. Some of them he did warn that she was taking sleeping pills. Most of them he said to that she was consenting to a sleeping pills. This was a game that they like to take part in as a couple.
That she was faking it?
Yes.
That she was faking she was sleeping?
No, that she was taking the sleeping pills herself because this is something that she liked and enjoyed. And you can see him on the videos egging the men on by telling them that she likes it, she enjoys it, she wants more.
And yet you hear in the video this horrific drone of her snoring to see how deeply drugged she was.
Really, really intense snoring to the point that one of the accused said that he had tinnitus. And he had bad hearing, which is why he didn't hear her snore, and that was his defense. But you can very, very much hear her snoring. And he recruited them online, and there was a whole process that they had to go through so that she wouldn't know in the morning that she'd been raped. So they had to not smoke, not wear cologne, cut their nails short, take their clothes off in the hallway, warm their hands before touching her, so that, one, she wouldn't wake up, and two, she wouldn't know the next morning that she'd been raped.
So she finds out about this because her husband is caught at a grocery store, what it's called upskirting, trying to take pictures with his cell phone up women's skirts.
Exactly.
And the police come to the house and take his hard drive, and that's where they find thousands of videos and photographs of something completely different.
Yeah.
His wife being raped.
He's caught upskirting. They convince the vigil who caught him upskirting has to really convince one of the women to go to the police with us. She doesn't want to, but he pushes her to. And because he's arrested, they get to go through his phone. And because he's in police custody, they also get to go to his home. And that's where they find the hard drive, where he had a folder titled Abuse, where he'd methodically cataloged every single video over 10 years. Videos with the name of the rapist, videos with the name of the act. And
then you have his children, her children, their children, what, two boys and a girl, mm-hmm. and then they've grandchildren, saying something's wrong with mom. She is forgetting everything. She is, and the husband, who's the rapist and recruiting everyone else to rape her,
takes her to the doctor because she's losing her memory. But this is from being heavily drugged.
Exactly. She wakes up one morning, looks at herself in the mirror, and she's got a haircut that she doesn't remember getting. She goes to her hairdressers to apologize, and they say, yeah, you seemed very odd, like you were out of it. And so she, for 10 years, was consulting doctor after doctor after doctor to find out what she was wrong with her. She thought she had only early onset Alzheimer's, but no doctor could figure out what was wrong with her. Her doctor, her husband kept taking her and kept, you know, making quips about, you know, what are you doing that you're so tired? What are you doing at night? And so, yeah, that's maybe one of the things that will be beneficial after this case, is that doctors will know to watch out for the symptoms of chemical submission.
So if you can talk about that moment when she decides, I am not going to be anonymous. I'm going to flip this script. I am not ashamed. I didn't do this. I was the victim. When she took off her sunglasses, allowed the videos to be made public.
So, yeah, from the testimonies of her daughter and of the reporters who first followed the case when it came out in 2021. At first, she was very, very scared of the publicity. Her name in the article in 2021 is not given. And she spends about 2 years in hiding. And then little by little, as her lawyers tell her that she has to watch the videos ahead of time, she has to prepare herself for what's going to be shown on trial, she starts watching the video with her lawyers. And that's when she gets progressively angrier and decides not only that she's going to make it public, but that she's also going to fight the court to make it public, because they're very, very opposed to it originally. So it's not just her deciding, but it's her fighting for it. For a few weeks, the court took back the publicity of the trial. For a few weeks, it was closed.
Talk about the scene in Avignon outside the courthouse, the women there and all over who started to rally around her.
Yeah, so you have to get there very, very early. So the court opens at 8, but you have to be there at 7 at the latest to line up by the courthouse. And there's a side room where the public can go. But there's only 60 seats in the courthouse. And the day I went, 30 of them was reserved for journalists, because increasingly journalists were coming in from all over the world. There were, I think, 175 that day. And so the women are lining up, and I found it really extraordinary in line, sort of a sorority that immediately appeared. Women that I had met 2 minutes ago were telling me about why they were here, telling me about their raves, telling me with their experience with chemical submission, being drugged one night, waking up in a strange bed, and sort of circles were forming within the line of people talking to one another and supporting one another. And really, we were all here to wait for Giselle, but we're also all here for one another. It was quite surprising. I thought it was going to be only bleak, but there was this really surprising sorority.
And you write about how you found sisterhood. Explain.
Yeah, so, yeah, I was very distraught going there, distraught while watching the rape videos. I'd originally intended to go later on so that they wouldn't be showing the videos, but they ran late and I ended up watching, sitting through them. But the woman next to me was as distraught as I was, and she grabbed my hand as we watched the videos, and that was quite extraordinary. She didn't let go until the video stopped playing, and then everyone, all of the women attending, it's a small town and there's only a small break for lunch, so we all go to try and eat something despite what we've seen at the same restaurants, the same boulangeries in Avignon, and we stuck together all day, and that was quite extraordinary.
Can you talk about the issue of consent and talk about French law and how people are trying to change it now, and also men's responses to this? Because let's be clear, that website Coco, where the husband recruited all these rapists, which, by the way, were her neighbors, people she would pass in the street, she had no idea. Mm-hmm. But Coco was shut down, wasn't it, by an LGBTQ group because they saw that gay men were being ambushed, recruited to ambush gay men mm-hmm. on that site. It wasn't shut down by her case.
No, it very much wasn't. And even though her case came out in 2021, it was only later that it was shut down. But yeah, on the issue of consent, it's quite tricky. We don't have consent explicitly written into French law. What qualifies a rape and what has qualified a rape since the late 80s is a sexual act performed via either constraint, menace, or surprise. And so obviously questions of consent come in to illustrate and sort of try and understand more of that, but it has to be proven that the act was committed by constrained violence or menace or surprise. And consent not being written in is very important because in French criminal law, and that includes rape law, the main issue is intent. And so to prove that you've not committed a theft or a homicide, you can try to prove that you didn't intend to commit a theft or a homicide. And it's the same for rape. If you can argue that you didn't intend to commit a rape, you might get a lower sentence. And so a lot of these men tried very hard to exploit that flaw. One of them was quoted saying, you know, I didn't know what consent was before this case, but thank you, Madame Pellicot, you've taught me about consent, and once the court frees me, I will create a seminar where I teach other men about consent. And so a lot of them were able to say also that they thought that she'd given consent because her husband said that she had. And so it's very, very tricky. Feminist activists are very, very divided on the issue of whether adding consent to the law would be better or not. Some of them say that it might put too much weight on the victim to prove that she was not consenting, rather than on the perpetrator to say that he didn't ask for her consent. That it might actually not be that helpful to women to add consent to the law, because you might get situations like this man who was saying that, you know, he didn't know about consent, and so he obviously is not his fault that he raped her. He did not intend to rape her. It was an accidental rape. That's the sentence I was uttered in court, accidental rape.
And it may be that Pellicot is a murderer as well, is that right?
Yes.
That his DNA has been matched to a cold case in Paris from something like 10 years ago.
Very much. And a rape case in Paris as well, which is why, you know, some people are very iffy with the case being described as the Mazon rape trial, because even on Gisèle herself, not all the rapes were committed in Mazon. He had her raped in a car by the sidewalk. He had her raped in a car in her bedroom in their daughter's beach house. It's not all about that one town
of
Mazon.
And there were even pictures of her daughter found who said, I don't know this underwear I'm in.
Exactly.
My father raped me, and he insists he didn't.
Yeah, so the kids of Gisèle say that the one who's really been forgotten and left out of this trial is the daughter, because, yes, there's pictures of her naked in her father's hard drive wearing underwear that she doesn't recognize, and she is convinced, and she's arguing, and she's founded an association to support people like her, who she says she's been raped, she says she's been chemically subdued. But unlike Gisèle, there's not a single video, and so you can't prove anything.
Well, Diane de Vignemont, we thank you so much for being with us. French journalist who covered the Pellicot trial in Avignon, France. We'll link to her piece in New Lines magazine headline, Gisèle Pellicot, Finding Sisterhood at France's Mass Rape Trial. Next up, we go to Bethlehem in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Stay with us.
Oh, little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie above thy deep and dreamless sleep. The silent stars go by, yet in thy dark street shineth the everlasting light. The hopes and fears of all the years are met.
Nat King Cole singing O Little Town of Bethlehem. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Palestine, where Christians are preparing for a second Christmas under ongoing Israeli attacks. As the number killed in Gaza has risen to 45,317, though the toll is likely so much higher. In the past 24 hours alone, dozens of Palestinians have been killed in Israeli strikes in Gaza. On Friday, the Palestinian theologian and pastor, Reverend Munther Isaac, delivered a Christmas sermon at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem, an occupied West Bank, the birthplace of Jesus, called Christ is Still in the Rubble. He'll join us in a minute. First, this excerpt of his address.
Never again should mean never again to all peoples. Never again has become yet again. Yet again to supremacy. Yet again to racism. And yet again to genocide. And sadly, never again has become yet again for the weaponization of the Bible and the silence and complicity of the Western Church. Yet again for the church siding with power, the church siding with the empire. And so today, after all this of total destruction and annihilation, and Gaza is erased, unfortunately, millions have become refugees and homeless, tens of thousands killed. And why is anyone still debating whether this is a genocide or not? I can't believe it. Yet even when church leaders simply call for investigating whether this is a genocide, he is called out and it becomes breaking news. Friends, the evidence is clear. Truth stands plain for all to see. The question is not whether this is a genocide. This is not the debate. The real question is, why isn't the world and the church calling it a genocide? It says a lot when you deny and ignore and refrain from using the language of genocide. This says a lot. It actually reveals hypocrisy. For you lectured us for years on international laws and human rights. It reveals your hypocrisy. It says a lot on how you look at us Palestinians. It says a lot about your moral and ethical standards. It says everything about who you are when you turn away from the truth, when you refuse to name oppression for what it is. Or could it be that they're not calling it a genocide? Could it be that if reality was acknowledged for what it is, that it is a genocide, then that it would be an acknowledgement of your guilt? For this war was a war that was so many defended as just and self-defense. And now you can't even bring yourself to apologize. We said last year, Christ is in the rubble. And this year we say, Christ is still in the rubble. The rubble is his manger. Jesus finds his place with the marginalized, the tormented, the oppressed, and the displaced. We look at the Holy Family and see them in every displaced and homeless family living in despair. In the Christmas story, even God walks with them and calls them his own. So today, let us reflect on the child Jesus, the child of Bethlehem. At the heart of the incarnation, there is a child. And this child, in his weakness, he is our hope. He is our consolation. He is our strength. This child, let us remember, this child shook Herod's throne when he was born. And while there are some who talk about the Roman Empire or glorify Herod as great, we are the ones who sing of a child born to refugees escaping a massacre. Yes, it has been 440 days. It is 440 days of Palestinians' resilience, Sumud. Indeed, it is 76 years of Sumud. But we have not and will not lose hope. Yes, it is 76 years of an ongoing Nakba, but it is also 76 years of Palestinian Sumud, clinging to our rights and justice of our cause. 76 years of praying and singing for peace. I was thinking about it. We are stubborn people. We continue to pray for peace year after year after year and sing about peace, and we will continue to do so. And we will continue to echo the words of the angels, glory to God in the highest, peace on earth.
Excerpts of this year's Christmas sermon from Pastor Reverend Isaac Munther at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank in Palestine. Reverend Isaac's forthcoming book is titled Christ in the Rubble, Faith, the Bible, and the Genocide in Gaza. The Pope has repeated his call for a ceasefire in Gaza. He also unveiled this year's nativity scene at the Vatican, portraying a baby Jesus in a crib lined with a Palestinian keffiyeh. The Israeli government has now denounced the Pope for calling for an international inquiry into Israel's assault on Gaza to see if it constitutes a genocide. The pastor, Munther Isaac, is joining us now from occupied Bethlehem. Your thoughts on what's happening, on the Pope being condemned by Israel, on what's happening in Bethlehem the second year that Christmas activities have been canceled because of the more than 45,000 Palestinians killed in Gaza. Reverend Isaac, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Well, if Israel was true that they are engaging within the rules of war, then why should they be concerned if anyone, not just the Pope, calls for investigation into whether war crimes are taking place or not? Israel is clearly committing a genocide. I mean, the evidence is very clear. And of course, they should be concerned because if an investigation takes place, it's going to reveal truly what is taking place. And even here in Bethlehem, it's not easy. It's another Christmas with isolation, with Bethlehem being completely isolated from Bethlehem, more blockades, more gates, checkpoints outside of Bethlehem. And my fear and our fear here in Bethlehem is that there is no one who's going to hold Israel accountable. And that's why statements like this from His Holiness the Pope make a difference, because Israel needs to know that we live within a community that respects the rule of law. Otherwise, chaos will prevail if everyone just does what they can. And if the rule of might is right rules, then is this the kind of future we want to leave for our children?
Reverend Isaac, we spoke to you in our studio in New York. You came here to New York. You went to Washington, D.C., as the Biden administration wraps up and President Trump is about to become president again, what are you demanding of the United States?
That it respects the international law. I mean, it cannot be the United States and Israel versus the rest of the world, as every United Nations vote reveals. Again, if the United States is honest about its call for freedom, ideals, human rights, then they should respect that and that they should abide by the international law. My message is that they are enabling Israel into politics that's leading the whole region into chaos and destruction. There can be other ways. There are other ways. And we're tired and sick of these wars, which are enabled by American tax money and American politics.
Tell us more about Christ in the rubble, and that image that you created in the manger last year, that you continue this year. We said well over 45,000 Palestinians have died in Gaza. Close to 800 have died in the West Bank under Israeli assault. Talk about the situation where you are.
Yeah, I mean, we're still seeing images of children pulled from under the rubble. It's unthinkable to me that it's been more than 14 months now into this genocide, and we're still seeing the same images. It seems like we're powerless, and it seems like the world is content with letting this go on. And here in the West Bank, as we watch from Bethlehem what's happening, or Ramallah or Hebron, we wonder, are we next? Israel has made it clear they plan to annex the West Bank next year. What would this mean on the ground? Again, we live in this moment of anticipation, of anxiety. And at the same time, we're broken by the fact that the world seemed content with letting this go without serious efforts to make it stop or put accountability and restraint on those who commit war crimes.
Reverend Munther Isaac, we thank you so much for being with us. Palestinian Christian theologian, pastor at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in occupied Bethlehem, where his Christmas sermon this year was titled, Christ is Still in the Rubble. He was speaking to us from Palestine. That does it for our show. A happy birthday to Yusra Razuki. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenup, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land. Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, Le Chablais.